Welcome to I'm Ready for My Close-Up. I'm Virginie Selavi, editor of Electric Sheep, the magazine for transgressive cinema, which can be found at www.electricsheepmagazine.com. Today's programme is about Peter Watkins' incendiary fake documentary Punishment Park, made in 1971, to tie in with the Blu-ray and DVD release of the film this month. To discuss Punishment Park and Peter Watkins, my guest today is William Fowler, archive curator at the BFI National Archive and the author of an article on Peter Watkins on the BFI's Queen Online website. Punishment Park mixes documentary and drama, an approach that Peter Watkins has pioneered and used throughout his work. His first production for the BBC was Culloden, broadcast in 1964, in which he filmed the 1746 Battle of Culloden as a news report. So Will, how innovative was that at the time?
Well, very innovative. Peter Watkins had come out of an amateur film background and had worked with local amateur actors, working in a very sort of minimal way, using handheld cameras, often getting people to improvise in front of the camera, and he took that sensibility to the BBC. So I think even just sort of very, very simple things like, this kind of use of handheld cameras, framing a historical battle and context with people talking to the camera, a newsreader sort of sitting in front of people dressed in clothes from that time. Also actually identifying individual people involved with the battle. So very often he zooms in on individual faces and identifies those people. So it actually helps you get a real, in a way, identify and sympathize with the people who are fighting. And he was really trying to make connections between this quite controversial battle that had happened some 100 years ago and what was happening then.
You mean the Vietnam War?
Yes. So, I mean, the docudrama form, which we'll go on to talk about in a bit more detail, hadn't really developed yet. So perhaps one of the most famous examples being Kathy Come Home, which was 1966, and that's a couple of years ahead. So, it really was very innovative.
And it was also about television conventions, right?
It was about television conventions.
Yes, was it sort of a commentary on the conventions of TV themselves?
Well, absolutely, because I mean, the way he was making something that looked like a documentary, and that the understanding would be that, that would be factual in some way, and there would be quite clearly things that we could understand. But actually, by using these conventions, he was actually kind of suggesting that maybe we shouldn't necessarily take things as true and actually highlight how we understand documentary and what it is we're watching when we watch television. So I suppose in a way to raise the consciousness of the viewer.
And this was quite well received.
Very well received. I mean, I think it got broadsheet press right across the board, was praised as being extremely innovative. It was sort of very engaging. I mean, one of the things that always really strikes me about Peter Watkins' films is that though he has this reputation of being a political filmmaker and working with the docudrama form, you watch his films and you think he actually could have had a career as an action movie director. I mean, although the cameras are set up and, he's kind of deliberately moving the camera a certain way, they're incredibly affecting and effective ways of portraying conflict and battle. And, they generate excitement in the viewer as well as hopefully raising the kind of consciousness of the person watching it.
Yeah, definitely. But after that, controversy started with the war game, which the BBC refused to broadcast in 1966, but which got a theatrical release in March that year. So the war game is a documentary that uses numbers and statistics from Dresden, Hiroshima and Nagasaki bombings, among others, to imagine what would happen in the event of a nuclear strike on Britain. It's a fascinating film because the narration makes it clear that it's a speculative story, and yet the dramatic representation is so powerful and feels so real that it's difficult to remember sometimes that we're watching fiction and not reality. What do you think of the way he mixes reality and fiction in this film?
Well, it's interesting. He's sort of thinking about it actually in connection with Punishment Park, because quite often he quotes like quite clear statistics about, as you say, what happened, the atomic bomb droppings at the end of the Second World War. But then, and these often come up as title on screens or people talking to camera, they're quotes from things that actually people said. But then they'll be quite sort of simple everyday things. So that there's a whole sequence where a camera follows someone driving down the road in a motorbike and into a building and then making an announcement. And that's, you know, that's been set up at the same time you're seeing something really happening. So yeah, traveling down the road in one continuous take. So even when it's not necessarily something like a statistic or something that can be referred back to something said before, there's this real sense of realism as well. So the kind of the lines between fact and fiction are quite can be quite blurred and not an obvious, not always in an obvious way as well. Mm-hmm. So it's very, as you say, it's a very powerful film.
And the performances are key to this. They're very convincing. I mean, the look on the kids' faces, for instance. I mean, it looks really like these people are suffering. How do you know anything about how he achieved that?
Well, I know. I mean, if you watch the films, he very often, as I said before, he often really focuses in on people's faces and crops the camera in a certain way, so you really get to see all the features in the face. And often they kind of look back at the camera and look kind of quite lost and bewildered, and that's very powerful. I mean, in some of the other films that he's made, he very often had people involved who perhaps could sympathise with the roles that they were playing. So, for example, in Punishment Park, the people who were sort of politically resistant to the current American government, they were actually people talking in the film and could perhaps draw upon their own feelings within it. But it's an interesting question with something like The War Game, because the people in it hadn't had those experiences of, you know, being somewhere where the atomic bomb had been dropped. So, I suppose again, it goes back to his work with an amateur filmmaker, and also with an amateur group in Cambridge, Playcraft. So, I suspect that perhaps was quite important for him, and working with actors and people, I don't know, who hadn't been to stage school and trying to get like good performances out of them.
Because they're all non-professional actors, right?
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, that's really that goes right through his career. I think it's sort of privilege is one of the few exceptions, when I don't think there's almost no amateur actors in it at all, but that's really the exception. And that's probably because it was, that's a Universal film, I think, from memory, so.
Yeah, yeah, I think that's right.
Yeah.
Do you think maybe people were able to draw on their, some of them anyway, older actors in there on their memories from the Second World War, maybe?
Well, yeah, that's interesting. I was just thinking about myself, actually. I mean, it's only really been not 20 years since the end of the war. So yeah, the older actors, I'm sure, could sort of draw upon, if you like, the Blitz spirit, or you know, the experience of being in the Blitz. And I think the Second World War obviously had a big impact on Peter Watkins. Mm-hmm. I mean, he was in National Service and had to move house because of the Blitz and what was happening then. And it's interesting to think about him in connection with other filmmakers and artists who'd been in National Service. I think there's a kind of almost like a National Service generation.
Like who are people you thinking of?
Well, so Jeff Keane is someone that I've done work on at the BFI. And his, you know, his war experiences are quite kind of drawn into the mirror in quite a visceral way. Like, his films are very, very violent. He collides all these different elements together. There's often these direct references to the war. So Meat Day from 68 has the sounds of bombers going throughout the film, even though you're not seeing that on screen. There's always references to films that have soldiers and things. So anyway, there's a whole generation of them. Peter Whitehead, I think, as well. It's another person that generation all had some kind of quite important early experience of war, and that's kind of impacted their work all the way through their life.
Mm-hmm. Okay. And you say in your article on Screen Online that the government, Harold Wilson's government, intervened to stop the broadcast, and that the Director General of the BBC found it too horrific. Why do you think the BBC and the government found it so shocking? What do you think they were worried about?
Well, there's a bit of a history, I think, with documentary and drama hybrids, which goes back to Orson Welles' radio broadcast of The War of the Worlds, which, you know, he started the broadcast, started speaking, and then at a certain point stopped and announced that the aliens had actually landed and invaded America. And I think, supposedly, if you listen back, it doesn't sound real. But when people heard this, people were actually really shocked and freaked out, and it had a really powerful effect on the viewer. So I think the story is that Hugh Carson Green, the controller of the BBC at the time, was worried that people might just turn over, you know, turn the channel on their TV and see this thing and think that it was real. I mean, I think there's different, there are different sides to this though, because I think there is this fear about the power of documentary drama hybrids, but also I think there's obviously a political component to this sort of insecurity as well. I mean, there's bits in the film where they're saying that reserves were to be held back for the social elites.
Yes.
It also shows how society could break down, violence, how like bodies wouldn't be buried. So I think in the BBC, in a way, you know, was quite close to those elites, and perhaps it had to be, you know, they had to be, not to say be careful, but was closely linked to the government, you know, through the license fee and things. So I could strongly imagine there being real political pressure about this film and it being seen as being very sensitive. And there's and then I think the story is that in the 80s it emerged that actually Harold Wilson had intervened, and it wasn't just that Hugh Carson Green had sort of didn't want to upset the viewers and cause panic. Actually, there was this larger sort of political conspiracy, effectively. And I know this Peter Watkins at the time, he was actually reviled by other documentary filmmakers and treated really atrociously for making that film. People even said, oh, actually, it's not a very good film, sort of, which is quite almost a pathetic way, really, of trying to deal with that. It's like, oh, well, I'm not actually going to have a political discussion. I'm just going to say it's not very good,
which is obviously
sort of pretty infantile,
not right,
really.
Yes,
no.
That's an interesting point, because it seemed to me that the voice of the narrator in the war game is a sort of implicit commentary on exactly what you've just said, on the because it has that very specific BBC tone with a very quite posh accent.
Yeah.
And it seems to represent, because at first, because you hear this and this is associated with the BBC, you think, right, this is the voice of objective truth. And then you realise that there is an implicit point of view in this, in the scenes that you mentioned about, like saying that some food will be kept for the law enforcement officers, and it says inevitably, and you can hear the point of view in there, that voice is actually on the side of the government and on the side of the authorities, and the surprise at seeing the middle class is looting, all that reveals the point of view, and I thought that was an implicit commentary on exactly that, the BBC being part of that elite or that establishment.
Yeah, I mean, it's interesting when you look at other documentaries that Peter Watkins has made. It's actually his voice who's narrating most of them. It's actually Michael Aspel, I believe, who narrates The War Game.
Right. Okay.
But other documentaries, his other films tend to be Watkins himself, and in Punishment Park, he's, as you say, he's almost playing this kind of BBC documentary filmmaker within it. You just occasionally hear his voice, and it's always Peter Watkins who imparts the kind of concrete details. So, like, it's this many hours and minutes until the American government or these soldiers are going to be let loose to go after the detainees, and then what the temperature is, how certain guns work. There's this kind of quite particular factual information that's always imparted by Peter Watkins. So that's that. Yeah, that kind of type of voice and the authority that it lends, and that those kind of stars of documentary filmmaking all sort of tied up together, I think.
Yeah, and it seems to me that in The War Game you see this already starting, but the fact that no matter what specific issues he deals with in his films, the ultimate antagonist for him is actually the media or
documentary makers. Yeah, it's really pronounced, I think, by the time of Punishment Park.
Mm-hmm.
But I think, I mean, just to go back to Culloden, I think it's interesting that he was trying to draw parallels with the coverage of the Vietnam War that was on television at the time, and that was the first war to be televised, as is sort of famously said. And there is this kind of violence in it, and there is this certain way of presenting the news report as it is in Culloden, but people didn't make that connection at the time. But you wonder, with The War Game, it's funny because it's this funny thing where it's both a sort of speculative fantasy, well, not fantasy, but a speculative documentary about what's and how it would be, but then at the same time it's kind of presented as a documentary as it's happening. But then, of course, if the bomb was dropped, then that documentary would never actually be made. So it's kind of a curious place to be in, watching it.
Yeah, it's very strange. And even though the narrator keeps telling you things like, in the event of this would happen, and you know this is all like a scenario that is imagined, you still, because it feels so real, you have to catch yourself and think, oh no, no, this is not happening. You really believe it's happening. Mm. So I can understand why the BBC might have been worried that people would think it was real. It feels really real.
Well, it's funny because I think there's also these moments, you know, you've got the high drama and the violence and it's very shocking, but then you have all these other quieter moments which I think give the film pathos and adds to its realism. So it's been a little while since I've seen it, but there's a sequence I remember when there's a funeral and they have a gramophone record and they try and wind it up and it won't play properly, I think. And it sort of gives this kind of almost like bleak humour in there as well. Yeah. Like it's so absurd as well, but it's kind of got pathos as well. And I think these little moments help kind of communicate to the viewer some kind of sense of realism as well as the high shocks and drama and, you know, the great way that he shot the action sequences.
Yeah, definitely.
All these things come together, I think.
Yeah, he's a master of the detail.
He is, yeah, absolutely.
Right, so on to Punishment Park.
Yes.
So in 1968, Watkins was in the United States working on an educational film project that eventually fell through. But he decided to stay and make a film about what was happening in the country at the time. The incident that specifically triggered the project was the Kent State Massacre, in which 4 students were shot by the Ohio State National Guard. But the film was made in reaction to a number of things, including the escalation of the Vietnam War, the growth of the peace movement and its violent repression, the trial of the Chicago 7, in which 7 prominent militant hippies were charged with inciting riots, and the trial of Black Panther Bobby Seale. Punishment Park presents itself as a documentary made by British and West German crew about the way in which the American authorities deal with political dissidents. The film alternates between 2 groups of dissidents, one group being tried in an emergency court in a desert tent, and the other having chosen Punishment Park over lengthy prison sentences being made to run across the desert in extreme heat to reach a point marked by an American flag with police and National Guard officers chasing them. So what do you think of the docudrama form he uses in Punishment Park? How has it evolved from his earlier work?
Well, I sort of think about this and I think, you know, it is a different type of film to the things that he'd made before. I mean, again, it's docudrama, but it does have a different form and it generally feels informed by the type of films that were being made at the time. There are no sort of intertitles that come up on screen. There's no narration really telling you what's going on. I mean, occasionally Peter Watkins is kind of making little comments, but the inference is that he's actually there and he's in a way almost part of the events and telling the viewer what's going on. There's of course also the development of 16mm technology, mobile synchronized sound, 16mm technology. So what was called direct cinema and cinema verite had kind of really developed by that point more so than they had when he'd made his films before. So basically this meant that people could go around with a camera and the sound man would be able to record the sound. As soon as the cameraman turned it on to film something, the sound would automatically be picked up by the tape recorder operator, whereas previously you'd had to have had a slate and it would be quite sort of formalised and less fluid. So it gave cinema documentaries a much more kind of impromptu, immediate kind of quality. So you kind of sense that in there. More kind of on the ground type of documentary filmmaking than perhaps he'd done before. And I mean, it's interesting just sort of stylistically, I think that, you know, there are elements that you can see that connect with, say, the War Games. So this kind of factual details that he wants to kind of get in there to sort of to show you, say, okay, well, this is a speculative scenario, but actually these are factual elements. So for example, there's a sequence, then the National Guardsman is going for all the guns that they have and the effect that they have. And that becomes a dramatized sequence rather than Peter Watkins, telling you, kind of listening to them or having some text on screen. So it becomes the guardsman telling the other guards what these guns do, how they work. And I think the inference of the viewer is, in a way, is to generate shock at just actually how the extreme violent capabilities of the American government is. But it's really kind of carefully integrated into the script. It's quite powerful, I think.
Yeah. And of course, the cast once more plays a very, very important role.
Yes, yeah,
and
absolutely.
You touched a bit on that before, but some people actually play themselves, essentially, right?
No, absolutely. I mean, I think in the same way that a Derek cinema film would be made, we're both just going around shooting interviews, just shooting lots of stuff and the film coming together at the editing table. I think with this film, in a way, the same kind of approach. There was extreme amounts of improvisation, just people having kind of maybe roughly having to sort of play out some kind of dialogue, but people would just kind of say what they're feeling. So very often, I think the people who are in the film were people who lived locally, but actually had the political views that the characters they were playing had. So on both sides, so both the dissidents and the people sitting in the courtroom were, I think some of them were former police officers, for example. So the actual dialogues going on in front of the camera often were very genuine and got quite violent. And then some, one of the people in the punishment parks, rather than the trial sequence, went on to be charged for a bombing incident, and I think he had there was some other history of him having run-ins with the law as well. So almost if he'd gone on from making that film to actually be some kind of political revolutionary and agitation of force. So there's that kind of, I don't know, as you say, that the film draws on all these things that have happened before the film and is informed by that, but actually, I don't know. I mean, you wonder whether it actually further politicised the people who are participating in it.
Yeah. Yeah, it's just very interesting the relationship
between, yeah, absolutely.
Between fiction and reality in this. The other thing that strikes me about this film, and I think this is something that happens in all of his films, is that he only stretches reality a little bit further, but he really always goes from real facts. And in this case, he got the idea of Punishment Park from an existing American law, the 1950 Internal Security Act, which allows the setting up of places of detention for people deemed subversive by the American government. So this is in itself a very disturbing piece of reality, and it just takes it a little bit further.
Yeah, I mean, I think that's the real strength of this film and why it's so important, really, is that, say, the War Game was about sort of demonstrating the power of the atomic bomb and trying to almost wake people up as to what would happen if the bomb was dropped in this country. So there's this kind of speculative quality to it. But I think with Punishment Park, it's trying to draw people's attention to the fact that actually there this legislation exists that could actually lead to quite particular horrific, you know, political situation in the country. So it's kind of like pointing out this particular act, as you say, and then showing potentially what could happen by the fact that it exists and people aren't aware of that. And I think perhaps, as you say, the shooting at the Kent State University kind of show how horrific things could be. And I think if you watch Punishment Park cold, it's really quite a shocking film, I think. And you sort of think, oh, he's exaggerating or he's taking it, you know, way too far. But I think the actual context in which it's made is really important to remember.
Yeah, definitely. There's an interview on the DVD Blu-ray that's coming out where he explains all this context, and it's definitely worth watching.
Okay.
And also here again we find a new stage in Watkins's critique of the media.
Mm. Well, there's a sequence where one of the detainees is actually directly commenting on the fact that how, when documentaries are made, how they get used and how people get misquoted, and how I can say something now about it but it'll get misused by the people who are shooting this film. So this the subjectivity of the media and how things get manipulated by the media is like directly referenced. And I mean, that's obviously, as you sort of said before, that's obviously something he's thought about in the previous films, but he has this character almost say his lines and his thoughts about the media at that point.
Yeah, and there's also the fact that most of the film crew just follows the events and doesn't really intervene, even when it gets quite violent and disturbing.
I know, and that's kind of interesting itself, yeah.
And even then, they sort of question what the guards are doing, but very timidly, so that itself is a comment.
Absolutely.
And what do you think, because it's quite shocking also the reaction of the critics in the film industry to this film. It was essentially banned by the fact that no one would actually show it or distribute it, right? I mean, it was shown once, I think, in New York at the festival.
Okay, I don't know so much about its exhibition history. So.
Yeah, no, it seems, I mean, we were talking before about what's happening with Ken Russell.
Yeah.
You think this is a very important British director, and his work is not actually that widely available or shown in the cinemas, and that film in particular was sort of suppressed or marginalised is the word that Peter Watkins used. What do you think of that?
Well, I think it's a funny thing, really. I think there's a general question about creative British film directors in that there are actually very few that we celebrate and call our own. Like, there's just, I think that's a broader problem, actually. And as you say, Ken Russell is someone who's made, you know, an amazing amount of really, really interesting, amazing films, and that, you know, he hasn't really been given his fair due. And you know, Peter Watkins is another one, and there are people who have actually almost had to move abroad to continue their career. So whatever you think about him, Peter Greenaway is someone who's basically moved abroad and has more support in France. Andrew Cotting is another person who can't really get funding in this country. But I think, yeah, and it's sort of like putting it in context, because as you say, I think I genuinely believe Peter Watkins' films have been marginalised, but at the same time, he has been able to make films over a long period and made, you know, quite an impressive amount of really interesting, rich work. Yeah, it's just a shame. It's just a shame, I think, here that, you know, War Game and Culloden are relatively well known, or at least get discussed. But it's kind of like the later work is like almost invisible, and, you know, slowly more of it has been released on DVD. So Privileged by the BFI, and then some of the other ones like Punishment Just Park just coming out. But
what would you recommend in his more recent work?
Well, a lot of it's, I mean, it's quite lengthy, some of it. I mean, The Journey, which is a sort of like an update of The War Game, which is this sort of 14 and a half hour film, it's one of those real epics. It's quite an extraordinary piece of work. I mean, it's not available on DVD anywhere, as far as I understand. I was fortunate just to see it at a screening in London about 10 years ago. It's got a lot of the factual information, but he's very much kind of talking to people, and it's much more like a personal film. And he goes and meets different families around the world and talks to them about the threat of nuclear holocaust. And he actually tries to link up sort of families in Russia with families in America and different people around the world. And they show videos to each other, and he tries to kind of make these connections with different families all around the world. And it's nicely kind of segmented into these three quarter of an hour sections, so you can kind of watch a bit and then assimilate that and discuss it. And the idea was, when it was produced, that it will be shown in classrooms, so it was like an educational package. I mean, something like that, in a way. Why isn't, although that's a few years old now, and perhaps the details are not correct now. Mm-hmm. But I mean, that's something that would be terrific to have available in schools. I don't suppose it ever was in this country.
I'm interested in the one he made on the Commune.
Yes, La Commune, yeah, mm. Which is his last film from 2000, which is really fascinating. I mean, that's available on DVD.
Okay.
And again, I mean, that has... he worked very closely with actors, they're improvising. So, La Commune is about the Paris Commune of 1871, which is a radical commune that was self-organised and evolved after the Franco-Prussian War. And they sort of started to develop their own structure separate to the state, and eventually they were sort of viciously repressed. But it's interesting that they actually have the actors admit their own biases, talk about what their characters were thinking, and there's this very sort of human perspective on the characters and their motivations. And I mean, that's definitely worth checking out.
Okay, excellent. Right, we're coming to the end of the show. Thanks to Will Fowler for being my guest today. You can read his article on Peter Watkins on the website screenonline.org.uk. Punishment Park is released on Blu-ray and DVD by Eureka on January the 23rd. And you can read more on Punishment Park and other fake documentaries, including Ghost Watch and I'm Still Here, at electricsheepmagazine.com.